Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The recent protests staged by white supremacists a few weeks ago had a tragic end, with one person dead and 200 other counter-protesters injured. Here in the Midwest, it can be difficult sometimes to believe that something similar could happen. However, the Anti-Defamation League says that extremist groups may already have a small foothold in Iowa and Nebraska. The regional director of the ADL in Omaha, Mary Beth Muskin, says the groups are smaller and less effective so far.
You know, one of the nice things about being in the Midwest is that things come to us later, fashions, trends, all kinds of trends. Well, also hate. So, I think that we get, it's not that it's not here. We shouldn't be lulled into complacency thinking that it doesn't exist. But it's definitely on a smaller scale.
Who are some of these groups?
Well, I think some of the groups are the groups that you've been hearing about. There's some Nazi groups, some neo-Nazi groups. There's some white supremacist groups. And what we saw in Charlottesville was that all those groups came together. They're actually from, different sides of the spectrum and as far as white supremacy goes. But in Charlottesville, they came together united by hate.
Have you had any specific incidents with these groups in Nebraska in the past few years?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we can't really talk about them.
But it's not like there's nothing is going on, is what you're saying.
Oh, no, it is not like nothing's going on. Absolutely not. But the messages are a little more subtle. I think we've seen flyering on our campuses in Iowa and Nebraska. We've seen, incidents of banners being unfurled. We've seen swastikas pop up in unusual locations. So we've seen some, sort of underground activity.
Do you ever find that in the Midwest, like people living in a, fairly quiet, pleasant community, that people don't really even think that there are these elements in their area or in their world?
Well, I think we don't want to think that. I think that, anytime it's something awful, I worked with the public schools for 36 years, and anytime there's something awful, we'd rather feel like it isn't really happening here. And on the one hand, we're kind of right. It's not happening here at the same level as it's happening in our large cities across the country. But that doesn't mean it's not happening here.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that we don't have to be aware of what our kids and our neighbors are doing. And to be lulled into complacency is to really allow this to continue and to grow.
Right.
So it's definitely not the stance that we would want to take.
So what can the ADL do, and maybe what can, what can we do, the average citizens, what can we do?
There are things we can and should be doing. First of all, we don't want to gloss over the fact that this is happening. We want to actually acknowledge that it's happening and acknowledge what we want to do about it. And ADL has a petition drive. It's on our website, ADL Omaha, or our national website, to disavow white supremacy. We have Facebook and Twitter, which would keep you up to date on things that are happening if you wanted to keep more current on what was going on through the Omaha office. And Omaha covers Nebraska, Iowa, and Kansas. People should be encouraged to report hate crimes and bias-related incidents. It has to rise to the level of a crime to be reported to law enforcement, but it only has to be an incident, not only. But we accept discussion and reporting on incidents, and it's important to report incidents, because oftentimes things can be stopped at the incident level, and then it doesn't get as big as a crime. But if we let things that shouldn't happen go unchecked, then oftentimes they escalate, and when they escalate, it gets more angry and more violent. We can urge Congress to improve federal data on hate crimes and to support hate crimes laws in our states. We all have hate crimes laws, but they're not as inclusive as they could be. Not all. Five states don't at all, but Nebraska and Iowa do. So we're really lucky for that, but we'd like to see them strengthened. We have lots and lots and lots of free educational resources for educators and counselors through ADL, the national website, and, you know, what better place to be talking about this than at home around the dinner table or within our schools to inform our kids and families as to what they can do and how to get involved. We have opportunities on our webpage for programming. You can talk to administrators and counselors about our No Place for Hate initiative and contact our office. We would love to do more work in the Sioux City area. And that's a program that's actually run by the school for the school. So kids would form a committee with adult supervision, and it would be like a leadership committee that would look within their own school and see what they think is an issue, and then target that issue over the year with programming. So they might all sign a collective No Place for Hate form. They might have some assemblies. They might bring in a speaker. They might have a, you know, Be Nice to Others Day, or, you know, whatever the issue is within their school, K through 12, they can do that. And then they would receive a No Place for Hate banner at the end of the year. And they can contact our office to know more about that. And of course they can donate. So there's lots and lots of different ways that you can help. And what we have seen is, and it's exciting to see, is that, you know, in the rise of this awful experience of Charlottesville where people were, you know, were killed and died, and, you know, just the horribleness of the whole scene, you know, we're really seeing people rise up and say, this isn't what we want. This isn't what we believe America is, and what can we do? And I think that piece of it is exciting. Sometimes it takes something awful to, you know, to jar us into, you know, getting involved and doing what needs to be done. You know, additionally, I think in schools, we have a perfect opportunity to talk about this in a historical context. So, you know, current day national white supremacy and white nationalism, to understand that, you also need to understand the history of slavery, the Confederacy, Jim Crow and Jim Crow laws, and the civil rights movement, and all that builds up to helping you understand the whole. Additionally, deepening our understanding of the First Amendment and freedom of speech, and, you know, why we would allow people to speak out. And where that fuzzy line is between freedom of speech and stepping on somebody else's rights. And, you know, just in general, it's important that we work towards the promotion of respect and equity and justice.
That was Mary Beth Muskin, the regional director of the Anti-Defamation League in Omaha. For more information on extremist groups in Iowa and Nebraska, you can go to the Southern Poverty Law Center at splcinfo.com, where you'll find a map of extremist groups in all of the states. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Iowa Department of Education is supposed to respond this week to a petition filed by the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. The group has filed a petition that asks for a change in the use of restraints and isolation rooms in public schools. The issue has been especially vital in eastern Iowa, where there have been complaints of misuse of both practices and allegations of racism in how they're used. Daniel Zeno is a staff attorney with the ACLU of Iowa. Before you took this action, did you hear from people anecdotally or formally about their concerns with the use of constraints and isolation rooms?
We talked to families, you know, because we wanted to get a sense of kind of where this is happening. So we got mostly eastern Iowa. Yeah, actually, almost exclusively eastern, central and eastern Iowa. But yes, we have talked to you know a couple of families. I know the Cedar Rapids Gazette did a story on a 9-year-old who was put into a seclusion room because she wouldn't stop crying. Right, she was sort of crying uncontrollably, and they put her in this room. And the school district admitted after the fact that they improperly used the seclusion room. And so we, you know, it's instances like that where we think no kid should be put into what is essentially solitary confinement as a punishment, right? There are a whole range of things that school administrators and school employees can do to deal with discipline or other issues with kids, and we don't think solitary confinement should be one of those for discipline or punishment. So we joined with 6 other attorneys in filing a petition asking the Iowa Department of Education to change the rules about the use of seclusion and restraint. And so for us, it's a couple of issues. It's an issue of fairness, treating all kids, fairly. It's also an issue of racial justice. We know from information from the Department of Education and from this petition that often what happens is these seclusion rooms and restraints are used more often on kids with disabilities and also more often on African-American kids. There are a whole range of racial disparities in Iowa, and this is yet another one. And so we see this as a way to begin to address, some of the, that racial disparity both in school discipline and in the juvenile and criminal system. And so that's sort of kind of how we came to the issue.
What would you like to see changed?
So the proposed rules, they clarify, so they provide some clarity about what seclusion rooms are and are not, what physical restraints are and are not. They also make clear that seclusion and physical restraint should only be used in emergencies as a last resort, and they should never be used for discipline or to punish kids. So right now, only Iowa and only 4 other states allow seclusion to be used when no other person's physical safety is at risk.
So Iowa's in the minority here.
Yes, yeah. In comparison, 29 states have banned the use of seclusion and restraint specifically to discipline or punish kids. Some states, they're sort of when you can use them, there are some different regimes. But 29 states have said you cannot use seclusion or restraints if the goal is to punish or discipline a child. And we think Iowa should join that consensus of states and say, in Iowa, that should be the rule as well.
Are there any areas of the state or school districts in the state that you're particularly concerned about?
So for us, Mary Richard, Attorney Mary Richard, was involved. She filed a complaint specifically about the Iowa City School District. Our concern is not about any particular school district. Our concern is about kids across the state, because we know that there are school districts across the state that use these rooms in a variety of different ways. And so we think it should be the task of the Department of Education to make clear across the entire state, here's when you can use the rooms, only in emergencies, only as a last resort, never for punishment or discipline, so that that's clear across the state. So no matter where kids go to school, whether it's in an urban area or rural area, wherever they are in the state, they're all subject to the same rules.
So what happens next in terms of this petition you filed?
So what we filed was a petition with the Department of Education asking the department to change their rules. So it's a petition for rulemaking. It was filed on June 24th. So the department has 60 days, so soon, July, August, to make a decision, essentially, to either deny the request. So one option is they say, deny the petition to make new rules. We're going to keep our current rules. Or they initiate the rulemaking process where, the department sort of comes up with a draft rule. They put it out for notice, open it up for public comments. So that's where we are. We're sort of waiting. We're waiting for the department to make their decision on what they're going to do with the petition that we filed.
What will happen if they say, you know, no, we're not going to do anything?
You know, and again, I'm speaking only for the ACLU. We engage in a whole range of advocacy, including legislation and actual litigation. We, you know, are looking at our options, whether that's, you know, going to the legislature to say we think this is important enough that the legislature should pass a bill. You know, and so we have not made any decisions yet because we're waiting for the department. But, you know, if depending on what the department does, we will explore all of the other options that are available to us to make sure that we can begin to address this problem.
That was Daniel Zeno. He's a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union of Iowa. The Iowa Department of Education is due to make a response about the petition filed by the ACLU asking the state to limit the use of restraints and isolation rooms in public schools. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. This week, students at Iowa State, the University of Iowa, and the University of Northern Iowa start classes. Iowa State and Iowa were largely shaped in the 20th century by two presidents. At Iowa State, it was James Hilton, and at Iowa, it was Virgil Hancher. The two men were very different in their approach to higher education and the roles they thought their schools should play. Matt Kuhns writes about the men and their mission in his book, Hancher v. Hilton, Iowa's Rival University Presidents. Kuhns says the two men couldn't have been more different in their backgrounds. James Hilton came from a poor family, and Virgil Hancher had been to the best schools and had traveled abroad. Kuhns says Hilton had to work hard just to earn his bachelor's degree.
Just getting to school was difficult. He had to, board at the nearest, high school, which, of course, you know, brought expenses with it, that, you know, his family had difficulty meeting, and that was the start of, you know, years both in high school and in college when he got there. You know, how can I make enough money to pay my bills and still have time to, you know, do the courses that I'm paying for? He didn't finish high school. He got into North Carolina State just because the World War I was in progress and they were willing to overlook things like that. He went to Iowa State and, they decided that actually we shouldn't enroll someone who never finished high school. And probably, one of the first big breaks in his entire life was being allowed into Iowa State with kind of a, well, okay, we'll bend the rules for you.
Didn't he tell his son, and his son told the story about how his father actually lived over a hog barn?
At one point, as part of the whole wartime situation, not only was he allowed to enroll without finishing high school, but he got, free board at the school. Well, after the armistice, they didn't kick him out of school, but they did kick him out of the dorms. So the next place he was able to find to live was, yes, above the school hog barn in an apartment that he actually shared with another young man, which is just amazing that there were two, individuals who were willing to go that far to stay in school somehow.
I would think he was pretty successful when he went out to work as an extension agent. And did he sort of go back and forth between working and going to school? Was it a money issue still?
After he finished his degree at Iowa State, he worked for extension for a period. I think his idea was that he would save up enough money that he could finally, keep up when he went back to do graduate studies. And I think that was successful. But up until then, from the time he was in high school through that first degree at Iowa State, it was constantly, get a semester, maybe a year in, then have to suspend studies for a while and go earn some money, and then back and forth repeatedly.
How did he end up coming to work at Iowa State and getting to the presidency? Because that's a pretty steep climb.
James Hilton's arrival at the presidency was one of the things that you've heard called an overnight success, years in the making. He really worked his way up. He was at, I believe, Purdue, and while he was there, he worked his way out from a fairly low-level job in, I think, the dairy department there. He continued studying. He went off to University of Wisconsin to get a higher degree there. Then, you know, while he was at Purdue, he did well enough that North Carolina State made him an offer for something. And in fact, he got an offer from Iowa State also. He thought, well, you know, things are good enough for Purdue. And then finally, after years there where he had really built what was almost a national reputation for his work at North Carolina State, the offer from Iowa State came in. But this was all, you know, he got his first degree at Iowa State in the 1920s, and it was 1953 when he was hired there. So we're talking, you know, decades just slowly toiling his way up the ladder in land-grant colleges.
Whereas Virgil Hancher, he was a very erudite person. He had gone to college in, at several different places. I believe he had a law degree, he had a master's degree. He was a successful lawyer. How did he end up coming to Iowa?
He stayed in touch, even though he made his, you know, most of his adult life and career in Chicago after finishing his last degree. He stayed in contact with the university. I think he had a lot of love for it. He was involved with the university club, did fundraising to build the Memorial Union. And by the time they came looking for a president, I think in a lot of ways he had every qualification you could want, except unlike President Hilton, he had basically no professional experience working in higher education.
So Hilton was in some ways better prepared.
I look at the two of them and their careers. You know, Hancher was very promising early on and got, you know, the success and the degrees, whereas, you know, Hilton had this very, very rocky start. But then somewhere in the middle, you know, Hilton stayed in academia, you know, worked at it year in, year out. And by the time he was called up by Iowa State, he was a fairly obvious candidate. North Carolina State wanted to make, you know, put him in charge of that college at the same time the offer came from Iowa State. Whereas by the time Virgil Hancher was hired by University of Iowa, he had, you know, not been working in academia. He never really had, aside from teaching one short course while he was a graduate student. So in that regard, his resume had kind of fallen behind President Hilton's.
I wonder, though, what their visions were. I know that Hilton had this sort of 10-point plan to change Iowa State University, which at the time wasn't a university. What about Virgil Hancher? What did he want to do?
I think he wanted the University of Iowa to be a great liberal arts university. I mean, he saw it really as, you know, there's no reason why this can't be, you know, an internationally renowned school in a very traditional, you know, a strong liberal arts sense. He was very committed to liberal education, thought a lot about it, wrote a lot about it. There's an article in Time at one point in his presidency that one of the achievements he was proud of was, you know, they described him cutting away a lot of the clutter of vocational courses that had built up. And he tried to, you know, streamline some of that and really develop this you know, strong core of, you know, liberal education. And he was also looking after the professional colleges, you know, the university of the College of Medicine came very close to falling apart. So he, you know, shored that up and created the nursing program, got that turned into a college.
Wasn't there an idea that Virgil Hancher had to make a state University of Iowa system?
There were two occasions when Hancher proposed doing this. I would say even then he was largely reacting to things coming out of Iowa State and said, well, you know, we've got these schools that are now trying to just grow off in all these directions willy-nilly, and the Board of Regents is not doing a good job of reining them in. So we should really have all of the schools, you know, really have a common administration. And I don't doubt for a second that he actually believed in this wholeheartedly and thought it was a good idea. So, yeah, there were a couple of times. Once in the 1950s, he proposed. On that occasion, I think he had a proposal basically for you know, you would call it harmonizing all of these administrative, you know, elements to the university and the other schools. He didn't actually say, well, I think we should have just one university with campuses. He said, I'm neutral on that. Although I looked at his list and said, well, if you did all these things, it wouldn't make much difference whether they were still called independent schools in names. They would have had, you know, a single administration in practice. And then later, toward the end of his presidency in the 1960s, he came out and had, you know, much the same proposal. And this time he just said, you know, we should create a, you know, a single university system, and they would just have, you know, Ames, Iowa City, and Cedar Falls campuses. And that did, especially the second time, That did draw a very, very firm negative reaction from the Hilton administration.
When both of these men retired, they both had plans and things they wanted to do, but Hancher never got to do most of those things, did he?
No, he did not. And it's, you know, I feel like a great loss in a lot of ways. President Hancher, I believe he only lived 1 year in retirement. He was working in India as this consultant for the Ford Foundation. And that was going to last 2 years. After that, he was going to come back to the university. He was going to teach law. I'm sure there were any number of, you know, subjects he would have, you know, loved the extra time to write about. He probably would have left some kind of memoir. Never got to do any of these things. So, yes, he, you know, who knows if he had lived to be, you know, 70, 80 years old, how much he might have got done, and just that never happened. Here was the complete contrast. President Hilton lived to ripe old age, you know, went back to North Carolina for a while, did, you know, consulting work there. Some of it, I'm sure, you know, would have been a great interest, the kind of thing President Hancher would have loved. You know, he saw his children grow up with grandchildren. He lost his wife, but he married a second time, settled back in Ames, where he, you know, was basically a hero. You know, he was there when they opened Hilton Coliseum. I'm sure he was, you know, a love figure in town. He and his wife were both very involved in, you know, boards and committees and things like that in Ames. So I imagine, you know, few people other than Fred Hoiberg have ever been, you know, more of a, you know, beloved, you know, living treasure in the city of Ames than James Hilton in his retirement.
That was Matt Kuhns. He's the author of Hancher v. Hilton, Iowa's Rival University Presidents. Classes started at all three state universities this week. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. There are a lot of museums out there, history museums, art museums, but how about a funeral museum? An Iowa undertaker has created one. Marty Mitchell is the owner of the Mitchell Family Funeral Home in Marshalltown and the creator of the Iowa Funeral Museum and Education Center. Mitchell opened the center this year in an effort to educate people about the funeral industry yesterday and today.
We have people that will come in here and they'll reminisce about maybe grandma or grandpa was laid out in the home when they were small children, where the funeral was there. And I just thought, well, you know, a safe environment that they can ask any questions they want, whether it's related to the history of it or whether it's related to, hey, you know, we're thinking of cremation. You know, what? Tell me about that. Or, you know, we heard this story or, you know, all that they could get their answers done. Resolved.
Right. And also, when most of us have been in a situation where we're in a funeral home, certainly it's not that usually the happiest of times for most
Correct.
People.
Most time when people come into a funeral home, it's because they have to instead of, you know, any other way. At that point, you know, it's a tough time for them.
How different were things when it came to, you know, if you had a loved one who died, say, I don't know, 100 years ago, what would people do? Did they have funeral homes at that time?
They might have somebody in the area, and yes, actually, it was pretty typical at that time to have somebody that would be able to perform some duties. And, you know, they'd call him the undertaker because that's the person that undertook the job that no one else wanted to. That's kind of where you get that term of. So they would build the casket, but a lot of times it was either a family or neighborhood type function where the neighbors would come in, provide dinners, meals. They would sit with the family, take care of them, take care of the kids. It was a community effort on that.
Well, when you started looking at things you wanted to put in this museum, I guess the first question is, what kinds of things were you looking for, and where do you find these things?
Yeah, actually, I've been, just as a personal collector, I've collected for about 30 years artifacts of that. And So I have a lot of it already, but a lot of them have come from Iowa funeral homes that have either closed or they cleaned out the basement or maybe consolidated with a different company as well. And so they came from there. Some of it, a lot of it really I get on eBay, different things. And so, you know, there was some access to that. I wanted to do a portrayal of what people perhaps would remember themselves. So we have display like Lincoln and John Paul II, his funeral, even Elvis. You know, some of the generations will remember that.
Right.
And so something to, the way we start out is, you know, even though Jackie Kennedy was an extremely private person, the way we go about that is saying that, you know, she wanted our country to have a funeral. She did not want to deny the public the chance for our goodbyes.
Exactly.
And she could have done totally different on it. But, you know, the funeral is still a very important event in people's, don't want to say lives, but, you know, it's the end chapter.
I would imagine, especially for younger people who don't have much knowledge about this topic, I bet they'd be surprised by some of the items they'd see and, you know, how things were done 50, 60,
right,
100 years ago.
Yeah, that's what we're trying to expose is, you know, to take away some of the fear of death, some of the fear of the unknown. You know, my grandma, she was 89 when she passed away, and not too long before that, she asked me one day, she goes, do they still stuff bodies with newspapers? I said, well, Grandma, we never did, you know. And she says, well, I saw in so-and-so's casket one time, I saw some newspapers sticking out by her arm. Well, what it was many, many years ago, and actually it was, a couple of places in Iowa. One of them was actually in Sioux City, had a casket company that was associated with Dubuque Casket, and all in on their more economical units on the caskets, they would use newspaper in the mattress. Well, anyway, she probably saw some of this newspaper sticking out and formulated in her own mind, we stuff them with newspaper. And so she was almost to the point of her passing and still thinking that. And that's where I want to try to help people know that there is you know, maybe things that they think of or have thought of in the past really isn't true.
How is the funeral business different today? I mean, there are so many huge companies today that have taken over smaller family-run funeral homes, huge makers of caskets, of vaults, and I imagine it's a much different place, industry to work in than it used to be.
It is, you know, and those fields where funeral homes have consolidated and casket companies have consolidated, it really portrays a very tough competitive nature. It used to be the rule of thumb was in any large city, like any metropolitan city, within 1 hour of the city, there were 7 casket companies. Well, now if you have maybe one or two, and they're all associated with some of the others. So the choices are not as predominant as they used to be. And probably the biggest thing that affects the casket companies is cremation rate, is where no caskets used at all. And so that kind of affects them. But for me as a funeral director, probably the biggest situation is family dynamics. Just in a community, you know, most of the kids and grandkids and all were within, say, 10 miles of each other. But now it's, if we have a family with 3 children, maybe one of them is local, but the other two I can almost guarantee are going to be out of state. We're having a lot of difficulty finding family members after a death. With not having landlines now and going to cell phones, it was very difficult to track somebody, even with the age of computer. There's a lot of abilities to be totally anonymous in the world. It's a lot of difficulties that getting people to be on the same page, because we can't uncremate someone. You know, we have to have everybody's agreements on it, everybody to come together and say, yep, that's what we want. We want to have mom cremated. Well, if one verbally opposes it, even if we have a majority, we can't do it. So it's a lot of times it's family dynamics that really play a lot into it.
That was Marty Mitchell, the owner of the Mitchell Family Funeral Home in Marshalltown. He's also the curator of the Iowa Funeral Museum, which is located next to his business. You can find out more information about the museum on Facebook. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. There are many different kinds of film festivals around Siouxland these days. The Sioux City Jewish Film Festival is being held tomorrow and Sunday at the Congregation Beth Shalom on Hamilton Boulevard and at the Betty Strong Encounter Center. Rabbi Guy Green of Beth Shalom says he's glad to see a Jewish film festival in a city as relatively small as Sioux City.
Major cities in the United States have Jewish film festivals.
Right.
For a town of 85,000 people to have a Jewish film festival, it's quite unique. So we're very proud of it. So every year we've been sponsoring various films from around the world, Israeli films, Jewish films, related to Israel, related to Jewish culture. And this way we're able to share with the broader Siouxland community Jewish culture, Jewish history, Jewish values.
Well, this year apparently it's going to be focused on food. What is it about food you think that's kind of a universal thing?
Well, the wonderful thing about Judaism is that the center of Judaism is not in the synagogue, but it's in the home. And the center of a home is its kitchen. And so the kitchen obviously revolves around the food that the people in that family make. So people gather around the table, and at the table we will celebrate Jewish holidays, many of the Jewish holidays. Every week we celebrate Shabbat with special Jewish foods, like challah, and you're supposed to actually feel like a king and queen on Shabbat. So the food makeup of the Sabbath is very, very rich. But other holidays too, like Passover, which we actually celebrate gastronomically the holiday through the history by eating the food of that history, as well as other minor holidays like Tu B'Shvat and Hanukkah. So food is central in Judaism and related to the gathering of the family, in the home. Why? Because at that table, you are supposed to actually discuss the Torah. You're supposed to discuss words of wisdom from the ancient texts of the Torah. So it's very, very important food. It brings everybody together.
I was wondering, it talks about there's going to be a movie about In Search of Israeli Cuisine. Is there a difference between, say, the kind of food that maybe a Jewish family would eat here and what we think of as Israeli cuisine?
You would think that it would be the same, but it's actually very different. I just came back from a group, an interfaith group from Israel a few weeks ago, and we experienced all kinds of Israeli food, which is really quite different in many aspects than American Jewish food. You can go to an Israeli hotel or an Israeli home, and there's a whole spread of food on the table, almost like a buffet of a myriad of salads, myriad of dishes that are specifically Jewish. So yeah, I think it is quite different, the Israeli food.
Is hummus a big part of it?
Hummus is just one part of it. There are many, many different kinds of foods. But you have to realize Israel is a multicultural country, and therefore it has many, many different kinds of cuisine. You have to remember 20% of Israel is Arab, so you have the whole Arab cuisine and Muslim cuisine, and you have Christians and Druze in Israel, as well as people from Ethiopia and Yemen and Russia.
Do you find you get a lot of non-Jewish people coming to your film festival too?
Yes, we do. We get a lot of non-Jewish people, Christian people, and people in our community who are just interested in learning about Jewish culture and Jewish history and Jewish values.
Are you going to have some food there?
Oh, yes. Whenever you have a Jewish event, you always have some Jewish food there. And especially with these movies, you really have to have some Jewish food.
That sounds good.
Yeah. It's always a delicious appetite, whether we're having a debate or speakers or a film, we always are very hospitable. This past month, we were in a Bedouin tent in Israel. And, for example, the Bedouins and the Arabs are always so hospitable. When you go into the tent, they're always served food from their cuisine. It was very, very interesting, and tea. So, yeah, food brings people together. Food makes people share something in common, even if their cultures are different. And it's a sharing, it's a giving, so it's a wonderful way to give, be generous and hospitable.
That was Rabbi Guy Green of Congregation Beth Shalom, where the first night of the Jewish Film Festival will be tomorrow night at 7 p.m. The second day of the festival is being held Sunday afternoon at the Betty Strong Encounter Center at 2 p.m. Admission is free.
The Ruralists are a band, a philosophy, bound up into one reeling package. They write that the true believers in the Ruralist platform know that art and beauty can be found hidden in the back of an old garage, and that their sound is a construction of all those things that are found in that garage, ancient oil pans, barn wood, and run through the filter of Northwest Iowa, its soil and beans. They've just put out an EP that brings these ideas to sound and does so beautifully. In addition to these things, the songs also contain the concrete imagery and love of language that is also a part of that philosophy, so far as I can tell. With me are Luke Hawley, Ben Lappinga, and Laramie DeVries from The Ruralists. Thanks for coming, guys. I really appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to meet with you. I'm always looking forward to your latest music, and this EP has been tremendous to listen to. It's been a little gift at the end of the summer.
Thank you.
I say that, and one of the first things I wanted to talk about is that one of the themes of this is death, which is a little heavy, but you treat it in a way that I think is unusual. It's not grim. It's kind of treated in a beautiful way. And that opening song that we heard the first few bars to is, it's called Evergreen. And I think one of the lines, a few of the lines that draw me to it are, well, this love we share, it's not new or novel or rare, but it's
but yours. But it sure is yours and mine.
Yours and mine. Yeah. And this idea that love is transcendent and beyond death, and you become the evergreen that the narrator of the song is buried beneath and existing beyond that. So it's a very mature idea of death, I think.
Thanks.
Yeah. Thinking of when you were composing this EP? I mean, that type of topic and approaching it in this way?
These songs are a little bit older than we are as a band. I don't know that I really thought about it. The song's having a theme. I do know that I write a lot about death, but I should probably make more jokes, I guess.
Yeah, but I think as the band came together around these some pre-existing songs that Luke had written, I do think that's one thing that I was drawn to, at least, in terms of the maturity of the lyric, so the depth that was there and addressing things in a way that was both winsome, and when you hear the songs for the first time, you want to hear them again and you're into it, but also there's depth there. And so I mean, for me, the topics even death, if we're going to talk about things that are meaningful, mm-hmm. we're going to talk about these things, and it's one of the great things about music and art is that you can do that in a way that's enjoyable and has all these different facets to the way that you can experience it. So I do think it factored into how I play and why I want to be in this to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the things that we like about it, you know, mm-hmm. as band members.
Yeah, and the other side of it is the way you treat love, and as that quote is said, as I quoted you, it's a love between two people that it's something that is not normal in popular music. Usually in popular music or rock and roll, love is very rare. You know, you're the first people ever to fall in love.
Yeah.
It's better than everybody else's love ever. But in this case,
a total eclipse of the heart.
It's, yeah, yeah, it is. Exactly. But this is quite different. This is like a recognition that many people fall in love, but that the love that you have between yourselves can be itself special, which I think is.
Yeah, I think my friend Jason Leaf talks about the idea of finitude a lot and sort of embracing the fact that you cannot have it all, like there's just not enough time for that. And instead of trying to have all of these things, to rather focus on the thing that you do have and try to do it the best you can. And that's how I feel about my wife, right? Like, I feel like lots of people have been in love all throughout history. But and in that way, what Sarah and I have is not new, novel, or rare, but it's ours. And it's this thing that we can continue to cultivate and to make as good as we possibly can.
Mm. The song Savages also deals with love in a way that seems to come from an experience perspective, and we'll play a little bit of that. Find yourselves thinking that humanity is just a bunch of savages. Maybe love is the one transcendent thing that we have that it brings us beyond that, but it's a pretty powerful lyric that coming.
Well, we can be, yeah. You know, I mean, it's not all we are, but I think we all recognize, you know, if we're going to have any realistic view of ourselves in the world, that's we can turn into that fairly easily, even with the people that we love the most.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the way that love is described in that. With it, you know, it's all these things together. It's hammer and nails and cement and shale, and it's this beautiful thing that rises out of something difficult and hard and like which is us and which is ruralism in a lot of ways. The way you describe yourselves coming out of this garage with, you know, rusty gas tanks and oil pans and things like that. But something great and amazing.
Well, I think it's something that is. There's an everydayness to it that I think is really important, right? Like, we live in a small town and we make the best music that we can with the people that we know how to, you know, interact with and the people that we love. And I think most people, that good love is that way too. I feel like pop music sort of damages the idea of love in some ways, and that thinking that it's some sort of only mountaintop experience or whatever, when really, like, it's the day-to-day, it's the commitment of it that for me anyway is sort of the most astounding thing about it. So I talked to a guy at work today who's a solar system expert, and he was, you know, sort of geeking out about the eclipse. And he said, you know, he said that, you know, the thing that is most amazing about it is that the sun is here all the time, like every day, all the time, right? And, you know, we got really excited about this eclipse, but it's always there, and it's always that magnificent. Right? Anyway, I thought that was a good parallel.
I think that's right. It's something that brought us the attention of something that happens every day. Right. And the attention that we're on we're traveling at these great speeds, and these huge, massive bodies around us are also traveling. It was wonderful. Yeah, I love the eclipse. But we are almost out of time. I think we'll hit a song and play it out. But before we go, I'd like to thank you guys for coming down and thank you for releasing the album. You can listen to The Ruralists on their website, fullyruralized.com. Follow them on Facebook and Twitter, or see them Sunday, September 3rd in Sac City at the Farm Butcher Table Pig Roast. I've been talking with Luke Hawley, Ben Lapinga, and Laramie DeVries of The Ruralists. Thank you guys for coming out.
Thank you.
When the sun goes down over this old town, we'll shoot the lights out in symphony, the stars. And though our time is short and our years are long, we will shake our fists at the fear of the dark.
And and you've been listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media, KWIT Sioux City 90.3 and KOGI Okoboji 90.7, broadcasting from the campus of Western Iowa Tech Community College. It's 72 degrees right now at the Iowa Great Lakes and 76 degrees in Sioux City. Coming up next, we're going to go to Freakonomics Radio. And coming up after that, stay with us for Fresh Air with Terry Gross. It's 1 o'clock.